You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Good morning. If you have your Bibles with you and want to turn to 1 Peter, that'd be great. You also find the passage in our worship guide and on the screen, too. 1 Peter isn't one of those books that people are jumping into to read all the time, but there are some real gems in it, despite it's a really short book. It gives us some phrases and some ideas that you might be familiar with that are referenced elsewhere. One of them is the whole idea about Jesus descending to hell. Do you remember that from Creeds? You know, so that the post-crucifixion, pre-resurrection Jesus went down into hell to kind of spring the pre-Christian saints from hell, right? Woohoo! Well, it's really interesting because in the primary first historic creed, the Nicene Creed, ain't in there. That's not in there. But it just goes to show that, you know, later on, there was somebody on the committee that must have really liked 1 Peter. And so by the time we get to the Apostles' Creed, guess what? He was crucified, and then he descended into hell. So if you grew up in a church where you read the Nicene Creed, you wouldn't hear that. But the Apostles' Creed, you would. So it's just another example of how you see the development of our faith and how things have changed over the years. And there are whole schools of thought and theologies around this idea about Jesus descending into hell. And it's almost kind of a throwaway phrase here in this letter. This letter has advanced Greek. Like when we were studying in seminary, Koine Greek, which my Greek teacher called G.I. Joe Greek. I mean, it's just the really basic Greek that the Roman soldiers would have spoken. I mean, Peter is much more advanced, a much more complex Greek. And whoever wrote it was familiar with Greek rhetoric and with Greek philosophy. And so we pretty much have said, you know, this was not the illiterate fisherman named Peter who wrote this. It was probably a second or third or maybe even later generation follower of Jesus who wrote in Peter's name for this. Whatever was going on, we know that there was some conflict going on. There was some persecution of Christians. And I'm not talking about, you know, Christians fed to the lions in official Roman kind of persecution. That was really, I mean, that was notable in its violence, but it was also not that frequent. Rome's official policy toward religion over the long haul was actually very tolerant of all the different religions in their empire. So probably what this is written to is something that we can relate to, which is social persecution, where your neighbors find out who you are and go, oh, you go to that church, right? I mean, that's kind of what this is about. And the author advises the readers to be steadfast and to persevere and that you attend to some of the practical duties of life with patience and with humility. So don't be proud. That's what this is all about. So let's hear our passage from 1 Peter.
And all of you must clothe yourself with humility in your dealings with one another. For God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty divine hand, so that God may exalt you in due time. Cast all your anxiety on God, because God cares for you. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Let's pray. We gather grateful for these words of wisdom that come to us from so long ago. May we hear them deep in our hearts so they might help us along the way as we strive to be followers of Jesus. Amen. A few years ago, Elmer Bernstein, he's the Oscar-winning composer of movie scores like The Magnificent Seven and To Kill a Mockingbird and The Ten Commandments and all of those. He was reminiscing about working with the director, Cecil B. DeMille. He recalled that he and DeMille had their differences about the Exodus scene in The Ten Commandments and how to handle that. Moses, you know, brings his staff down and the Hebrews start marching, you know, and there they go. But they weren't Hebrews in the film. They weren't. They were Muslims. In fact, they were 5,000 Egyptian army soldiers that had been hired as extras to play Hebrews in the movie. Now, DeMille thought that what Bernstein had written was too slow, too lumbering, you know. In fact, DeMille said to Bernstein, "I hate it." And Bernstein said, "Well, describe to me what you want." And, you know, DeMille said, "Well, I was really thinking something more along the lines of Onward Christian Soldiers." And Bernstein said, "Well, if that isn't the most ecumenical thing I've ever heard, you've got 5,000 Muslims portraying Hebrew slaves marching to Onward Christian Soldiers." Now, we can laugh at the unlikeliness of such cooperation, especially because we know how hard it is to even get along with people that we're like, right? That are similar to us in beliefs and makeup. But I mean, that's who we are, right? We divide ourselves into tribes by ethnicity, by common goals, by beliefs. We set up boundaries that define us over against the other. And I mean, what better proponent of our way of doing things than declaring that God is on our side, right? And that's not a new trick, right? But it's great that God's on our side and no one else's. I mean, when the Dalai Lama wrote about the three fundamental commitments in his life, he said that his first commitment is not as a Buddhist, not even as a Tibetan, or even as the Dalai Lama. He said that his first commitment, his first foundational identity, is that of a human being, and one devoted to the enrichment of the shared humanity that he has with mutual kindness and compassion. He knows what all of us need to get a grip on as we move deeper into the 21st century. And that is, we're going to have to readjust our priorities, acknowledging that culture and race and ideology, and maybe especially religion, divide us, keep us apart. But our common humanity is what brings us all together. I mean, and it's natural that people would be disturbed or disoriented or frightened even at the idea that God belongs to others as well as to us. But Christians forget that half to two-thirds of our Bible, the Old Testament, are Hebrew scriptures. Remember that? Where I'm guessing that it could be argued that God is pretty Jewish, right, in those passages. It's a surprise to some that Jesus was in fact a Jew and remained a Jew his whole life. And he showed no obvious inclination to create anything other than a Jewish tradition. Christianity is in fact a multi-faith tradition. It's a synthesis of Judaism and kind of baptized elements of all these different pagan and other religions that are cannibalized and brought together. They're all put in the Cuisinart. You know, and out comes Christianity. I mean, the common thing that we have is that we gather around the figure of Jesus, right? But it brings in things from all sorts of communities and cultures. Do you remember Copernicus? Copernicus was the guy who published what everybody else already knew but didn't want to say because the church rejected the idea. And that is, I know this is tough to think about, but he actually proposed that the sun was in the middle of our solar system, and that the earth revolved around it. Can you believe that? You can all shout at once, blasphemy, blasphemy, right? I mean, if you can imagine what a break with people's worldview that was, to think of anything other than the earth in the center of the universe. Theologian John Hicks says that we right now need another Copernican revolution. But we need to take Christianity out of the center with all of the other poor religions just kind of rotating around us, and instead put the mystery of the divine in the center and Christianity orbiting around the divine along with the other faith traditions. You know, all of us. Can we do that? Can we take our drilled into us imperialist, our way or the highway mentality and take our faith out of the center. And as our letter from Peter reminds us, to be on about clothing ourselves in humility with our dealings with others, to not be proud to the exclusion of others. Some are afraid of the idea that God could be greater than any one tradition. And they start to pout. You know, it's like, well, if I'm not part of the religion that is better than all the others, then what's the point? You know, I'm going to pick up my toys and go home. They forget what Paul said to the Corinthians, that the best that we can do is to squint through a fog, that we can barely see, peer through a mist, and all of our visions of the divine are partial and cloudy. I mean, I even sense myself going like this, and I'm like, no, you know, I mean, the divine, it's just impossible to comprehend, let alone describe. You probably heard the old story about the blind folks that came upon an elephant, and one, the one feeling the side of the elephant says, oh, wow, it's definitely, an elephant is like a wall, right? Another one is clutching the tail and says, well, an elephant is like a rope. And the other one is down by the ears and is like a thick blanket. You know, and you go on through the whole thing, one of the legs says, it's like a tree. And the one with the trunk says, oh, it's like a hose. You know, it goes on and on. Could it be that when it comes to comprehending the divine, that each of us has a different part of the puzzle? Could it be that when we try to control and define as our God is far beyond any of our imaginations? Now, that doesn't mean that our meager perceptions of God are invalid or untrue. I am a Christian. Some have questioned that. But we happen to be part of a tradition that understands the divine as revealed in Jesus. This is the springboard from which I experience the more. And I'm part of a way that has been evolving and changing for over 2,000 years. I mean, the earliest of Christians wouldn't recognize what the heck we're doing here, right? It has changed so much. But be it fear or tribalism or insecurity, there are a lot of people of faith who simply cannot practice their faith without it having a component of being right or being the sole proponents of the capital T truth. I mean, you know these people, right? Some of them are in your families. And we certainly have our fair share of them here in Fountain Hills, where we have been accused of ignoring the supremacy of Jesus and associating with those who are, quote, bowing down to false gods. That's an attitude that may have worked in isolated rural towns a generation ago where, you know, you might not have ever met a Catholic, let alone a Jew. But it doesn't hold up anymore. And it borders on being anti-American. Because, you know, one of the things that I love about the United States is its diversity. When I make a hospital call, it's not uncommon for me to interact with a melting pot of people from around the world. You know, there's the Indian surgeon, there's the Mexican anesthesiologist, there's the African nurse, there's the Eastern European volunteer at the desk, each one of them potentially from a different faith group, right? I mean, and look at your everyday life. My barbershop is owned by Russian Jews. The doctor that delivered Nat was an Iranian Zoroastrian. And, you know, we had a tantric goddess temple in our neighborhood until the police shut it down. The other night, we had a meeting of the Arizona Foundation for Contemporary Theology down at the UCC headquarters down in a neighborhood in downtown Phoenix. And at one point during the night, we were discussing, you know, really profound, how do you pronounce Sikh? Is it Sikh or is it Sikh? You know, S-I-K-H for the faith group. We never came to a conclusion. We walked out into the evening from the office there, and there in the darkness, I saw across the street someone who I knew would have the answer. Why? Because from his silhouette in the dark, his head was too big. He had a turban on. And so I moved across the street and I said, excuse me, sir. And he froze because he was like, oh my gosh, who is this coming at me in the middle of the night here? So I explained to him our dilemma. And after relaxing a bit, he explained to us that it is Sikh in India and that it is Sikh in America. And as the rest of the people gathered around, we found out that we had common friends and everything. And it was a great conversation that we had in the middle of the street there that night. And then we all went our separate ways. Of course, you wouldn't hold it against a Sikh in Phoenix for being a bit jumpy when someone shouts at them and stops them at night in the street. Because you might remember that the week after 9/11, Babler Singh Sodhi, a Sikh gas station attendant in Mesa, was assassinated by a so-called patriot whose unbalanced mental state allowed him to actually act on the hatred toward the other that the country was wallowing in back then. I don't know if you remember how thick the hatred of Muslims in particular was, but of immigrants of all kinds. Most people don't realize that the guy that shot Sodhi also shot a Lebanese clerk that night and an Afghani family shot up their house. We really have to be careful. In his book, God is Not a Christian, Bishop Desmond Tutu wrote, "Religion, which should encourage tolerance, respect, compassion, peace, reconciliation, caring, and sharing, has far too frequently, perversely, done the opposite. Religion has fueled alienation and conflict and has exasperated intolerance and injustice and oppression. Some of the ghastliest atrocities have happened and are happening in the name of religion. It need not be so if we can learn the obvious, that no religion can hope to have a monopoly on God, on goodness and virtue and truth." In other words, God is not a Christian. Now, to some, this seems like downright treasonous to denounce or our monopoly on God and to deal with other religions in a positive spirit. But the world is, I don't know if you've noticed, the world is shrinking. Yeah? And we will have no end of conflict if people from different faith communities don't learn to get along with one another in a positive spirit. Diana Eck is a professor at the Harvard Divinity School, and she wrote a book called A New Religious America: How a Christian Country Has Become the World's Most Diverse Nation. In it, she writes that diversity, that word, describes a state of affairs, while pluralism represents an achievement based on an affirmation of diversity. So pluralism is something we're aspiring to in a diverse community. To be pluralistic, she writes, there has to be self-conscious choice of promoting and accepting difference. You'd think we'd have this by now. You'd think we'd be better at it, right? But before we bowed to the pressure of anti-communist fear in this country and changed our motto to "In God We Trust," which only happened in the 1950s, you remember what our original motto is? E pluribus unum. What does that mean? From many, one. Right? I mean, that's what we're founded on. Dr. Eboo Patel, he's a Muslim and founder of the Interfaith Youth Corps in Chicago, says that the ability to engage diversity and build relationships amidst diversity is a central way in which we become fully human and, in fact, share in the divine nature. So he's suggesting that to be fully human, we have to embrace that diversity. In his book, How to Be a Bad Christian, Dave Tomlinson recalls when Amaka and Ansumana asked him to serve as an officiate at their wedding. And he said, while both were born and grew up in Britain, Amaka is half Nigerian, half Indian Christian. And Ansumana is a Muslim whose family is from Sierra Leone. They wanted a wedding jointly conducted by a priest and an imam, and both traditions were to be honored in the ceremony, both fully incorporated with no cheap compromises. So Tomlinson says, the day turned out to be a magnificent convergence of religions, cultures, families, and communities, with 300 guests comprising a rich and diverse community of assorted backgrounds, connections, viewpoints, and influences. He muses, how I wish I could bottle the spirit of that wedding, to release it across our world, torn apart by violence, prejudice, and terror, often in the name of religion. Yet I believe that this little event was simply a token of the aspiration of many people who loathe bigotry and intolerance and long for greater collaboration in creating peace on earth. I mean, isn't that what we do each year with our interfaith Thanksgiving service? It's our small token act that aspires to the idea that we can overcome bigotry and intolerance in healing the world. Hans Kung says, there will be no peace among the nations without peace among the religions, and no peace among the religions without dialogue and greater understanding between them. So regardless of what faith we come from, the overwhelming majority of us simply want to be decent human beings, don't we? I mean, customs and rituals may not be the same, but our religious beliefs are going to vary. But that humanity runs deeper than religion. I think every religious tradition affirms in some way that God is beyond the grasp of many of us, a mystery, transcendent. So how could God be a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or a Hindu? God is not some tribal deity, but beyond our comprehension. I mean, you've probably seen on the news or heard Muslims in gatherings saying, Allahu Akbar, right? Allahu Akbar. What does that mean? God is great, right? And so what most it's usually couched in the form of, it's like, you know, like you're chanting for your team, right? God is greater than your God, blah, blah, blah. It actually means in Arabic, God is greater. But it's not saying God is greater than your God. It actually means that God is greater than our ability to comprehend. God is greater than anything that we can say, anything that we can come up with. Now, I don't think that most of the people that are chanting that actually know that deeper meaning. They really are using it as a chant. But it's important that we know that even in traditional Muslim teaching, that it means God is greater than what any of us can comprehend. When the members of Heartsong Church just outside of Memphis, Tennessee, heard that the new Islamic Center was being built next door, they went and they put out this sign. Heartsong Church welcomes the Memphis Islamic Center to the neighborhood. And when they heard that the center wasn't going to be completed in time for Ramadan, the pastor invited their Muslim neighbors to use the church for their Ramadan prayers. Now, in a post-9/11 America, this made national news. And a group of Muslims in a village in Kashmir saw the report on CNN and were so moved that they went straight to their neighborhood church in Kashmir, where obviously the Christians are the incredible minority, right? And they cleaned the church inside and out from top to bottom. And in a message that they sent to the Heartsong Church, one of the Kashmiri men wrote, "We are now trying to be good neighbors too. Tell your congregation we do not hate them, we love them. And for the rest of our lives, we are going to take care of that church." Do you remember what else was going on that weekend? Crazy man in Florida was burning Korans. Do you remember that time? And we thought, oh my gosh, this is bad. Didn't hear so much about this. And when they have moved on and the Islamic Center is now complete, the two communities still work together to once a month they help serve the homeless in their neighborhood. And guess what? Heartsong is a United Methodist Church. Yeah? The future of religion does not hinge on theological solutions, but on human solutions. We desperately need to create new stories like this, of mutuality and hope that will generate a fresh spirit of respect and cooperation in building a more compassionate and sustainable world. That's why it's important to hear these words from Jack Spong and shout them from the rooftop. God is not a Christian. God is not a Jew or a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist. All of those are human systems which human beings have created to try to help us walk into the mystery of God. I honor my tradition. I walk through my tradition. But I don't think my tradition defines God. I think it only points me toward God. Just before he was assassinated, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote, "We have inherited a great world house in which we have to live together, black and white, Easterner and Westerner, Gentile and Jew, Catholic and Protestant, Muslim and Hindu, a family unduly separated in ideas, cultures, and interest, who, because we can never again live apart, have to figure out somehow to live with each other in peace." I mean, 40 years after he said that, we understand even more acutely the challenge of living together in this great world house. You remember what else MLK said? We have to learn to live together as brothers or perish together as fools. Let me close with this story from Bob Marley. Bob Marley, who was incidentally raised in a Methodist school, had this idea. He believed that you can cure racism and hate by injecting music and love into people's lives. He was scheduled to sing at the Smile Jamaica Peace Rally. And 2 days before that concert, a gunman came into his compound and shot him and his wife and several of his other companions there. Shot him down. 2 days later, with multiple wounds, he got up on that stage and sang his heart out. Someone asked him, "Why?" And he said, "The people who are trying to make this world worse are not taking a day off. How can I?" Right? And then he offered up our stream of thought for today. Light up the darkness. Light up the darkness. In times of change and uncertainty, when comfortable landmarks and have shifted or maybe even disappeared, it's understandable that people are going to long for things that are familiar and straightforward answers. But the future hinges on people who are going to embrace diversity, uphold their own faith while affirming the faith of others, and work together to light up the darkness, to spread a global culture of justice, friendship, and compassion. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.